here's a case study of this woman, Michelle Robinson, and just where her values came from and how her values drove her to do what she does. Oh, my God. I think this works when you're really close to that, but it doesn't work when you're very far away. That's okay. I'll just stay up here. So these are our 10 terms that we started out with, and we're going to be looking at three terms in particular today: indeterminacy, values, and confidence. Values, we're going to hit hard, and we're really going to concentrate on the values of Michelle Robinson. But we're also going to be looking at how she deals with indeterminacy, things that are not clear. There's not a clear path. There are multiple options. And how the values help her solve that indeterminacy. And then we're also going to talk about how she has the confidence to actually step up and do that, which is not easy in her case. So Michelle Robinson is this very interesting woman who grew up on the south side of Chicago. That's definitely the poor side of Chicago. And she ended up making a very significant contribution to improving the lot of disadvantaged kids. She had really amazing parents. These were very committed, very loving, caring parents. But they had very modest means. And her father was a very hard worker. He worked his whole career for the city of Chicago, basically keeping the boilers running in the power plant. But he had multiple sclerosis, was diagnosed early in his adulthood. And he was crippled. He had to take disability at a relatively young age, and then he died at quite a young age. So there was always the specter in the family that, you know, he was ill. And he was not going to be able to provide in the same way as he might have been able to if he were not ill. Her mom was just a terrific woman, very, very loving and caring. Didn't really have much education, was an administrative assistant. Both of them had jobs, they had you know, steady jobs, but they didn't make a lot of money. They had very modest means, and even their combined income was modest, and with always the specter of medical bills and you know, the uncertainty of his ability to work, that made them always a little bit unstable financially. So she grew up in this declining neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. As she said, everything that mattered was within a 5-block radius. My grandparents, my cousins, the church on the corner where we were not quite regulars at Sunday school, the gas station where my mom would sometimes send me to pick up a pack of Newports, and the liquor store, which also sold Wonder Bread, candy, and a gallon of milk. So it's a low-income neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. They lived on Euclid Avenue. It turns out I know this neighborhood really well. It's generally the neighborhood where University of Chicago is set, but there's University of Chicago as this little bubble, and then there's a very, very poor neighborhood around it. But she lived on Euclid Avenue, which is a major street there. And they lived in a little house that had two households living in the house. It had been built probably for just one household and had a little, like, mother-in-law apartment on the top floor. The mother-in-law apartment just had one bedroom, little living room, little kitchen, bathroom. But that's where her family lived. They lived in the little mother-in-law apartment above. But instead of it just being one person living there, there were four of them living in that very small apartment. So the mom and dad slept in the bedroom. She and her brother slept in what had originally been the living room. And up until a certain age, they just slept in the living room there. Their beds were in there. And then when they got to be teenagers, their grandfather put a little partition there so there'd be a little privacy between Michelle and her brother. But still, very, very modest, very cramped kind of way to live and grow up. She took piano lessons from the people who lived downstairs were her great aunt and uncle. And her great aunt gave piano lessons. Again, beat up old piano, very modest kind of situation, but she gives Michelle piano lessons. And then she talks about one time they had a recital, and they were going to have it in a hall that was outside the neighborhood. And, you know, she sat down to play her carefully rehearsed piece, but she's kind of shocked. She's sitting at a perfect piano, it turned out. Everything perfectly dusted, all of its wires tuned precisely, all the keys laid out like a glowing ribbon of black and white. But the only problem was, she says, the issue was I wasn't used to flawless. In fact, I never once in my life encountered it. Everything in her world was dumbed down. It was it was not high quality. So when she goes to play on this piano, she's freaked out. She didn't know how to deal with something that is that high quality or flawless. So that just gives you a sense of the context she's growing up in. She went to the local elementary school, which was Bryn Mawr Elementary. It was not a very good school. Most of the kids were not very motivated in that school. And in the second grade in particular, she finds herself in this classroom that's just mayhem of unruly kids. And there are erasers flying, and the teacher's totally out of control, does not have any discipline in the classroom. She couldn't figure out how to do it, and didn't seem to even care or care about the kids. Just, it was a terrible situation. And it also wasn't clear that anybody else in the school cared. I mean, this horrible teacher, this complete mayhem in the classroom. It's like, okay, that's normal, no big deal, we're not going to worry about that. But it was very disturbing to Michelle. Even as a little second grade kid, she says, every hour there felt hellish and long. I sat miserably at my desk, learning nothing and waiting for the midday lunch break when I could go home and have a sandwich and complain to my mom. She was just miserable in this crappy school where she wasn't learning anything. So unbeknownst to her, her mom goes to the administrators of the school, and slowly over a period of time, she complains and she, you know, works on them and hassles them. And after a while, she gets pulled out of class and installed permanently in a more orderly class that was governed by a no-nonsense teacher who knew her stuff. But this is really critical. In the second grade, she could have lost a year in a classroom where she was not learning anything. And she luckily had the kind of mom who went up to the school and said, that's not acceptable. And in a very, very quiet, very nice way, got her kid moved to a better classroom. But you got to think of everybody else in that classroom is just suffering through a year of not learning anything. And then when you get to third grade, then they don't know crap, and they're set back. Or maybe they have another terrible teacher in the third grade. But it was that kind of context, and, you know, she knew what that was like. So this is her kindergarten class, and you can notice that there's a pretty good racial diversity there. There are white kids, there are Hispanic kids, there are Asian kids, there are African-American kids. Probably predominantly African-American, but it was a mixture of kids, and that was in kindergarten. By the time it got to be the fifth grade, everybody's African-American. There might be one or two white kids, but everybody has gone. And she says every September at Bryn Mawr Elementary, we'd find fewer white kids on the playground. It soon seemed that anyone who had the means to was going away, that we're moving to another neighborhood. So her neighborhood is getting slummier and slummier. She says racial and economic sorting in the South Shore neighborhood continued in the 1970s, meaning that the student population only grew blacker and poorer with every year. And then during the time when she was in junior high, the Chicago Defender local newspaper ran a vitriolic opinion piece that claimed that Bryn Mawr Elementary had become a rundown, slum-governed ghetto mentality. Oh, man. I mean, she's in a bad situation. But extremely fortunately, just at that moment, the Chicago School District started a magnet school program. And she was lucky enough to test into Chicago's first magnet high school, Whitney M. Young High School. And it sat in a not very good neighborhood, but sort of at the border between the South neighborhoods that were very poor and the West neighborhoods that were better off. Built a brand new high school, and she was lucky enough to test into it. Now, imagine that her mom had not got her switched over in the second grade. Then she would have lost a year and quite likely would never have been able to test into Whitney Young. So her whole life is changed by that second grade moment. And if she hadn't had that, then she wouldn't have had the opportunity to go to this magnet high school. This is a big game changer for her. So this is Whitney Young High School, an entirely different scene from that at Bryn Mawr. There are about 1,900 kids at Whitney Young, and from her point of view, they appeared almost universally older and more confident than she would ever be. Looking around, she says, "I felt small." Now, she understands I came from this crap elementary school and junior high. Some of these kids at a magnet high school came from really, really good elementary schools and junior highs. And some of them came from families that could afford a lot of things that her family couldn't afford. So she's very aware that she is on the what she perceives to be the bottom end of this magnet school. So she says, "My worries about high school could mostly be filed under one general heading. Am I good enough?" So here we're dealing with that first of the three terms I said we'd be talking about today, confidence. So she's in this new challenging school, huge opportunity, but she feels like I'm just not good enough here. She says, "My initial strategy involved keeping quiet and trying to observe my new classmates. All I knew was that they were smart, the smartest kids in the city, apparently. And that intimidated her. But she says, "But wasn't I smart as well? Hadn't I landed here because I was smart like them?" The truth is, I didn't know. I had no idea whether I was smart like them. Not enough. She just felt like I'm not enough. And she felt like, though they accepted me because I was the best of a bad lot in Bryn Mawr Elementary School, but maybe I'm not really competitive with these other kids. She says, "It was doubt about where I came from and what I believed about myself. It was like a malignant cell that threatened to divide and divide again unless I could find some way to stop it." So you can imagine this kid as a ninth grader. She has a crisis of confidence. "I just don't feel like I belong here. I'm not good enough." And that malignant cancer of lack of confidence was just eating at her as a ninth grader. Now, also, I got to tell you, this was a rough life because she had to take a bus to get to this magnet school. And it was an hour and a half on the bus to get there. The most logical way was she would go from her neighborhood on the south side in toward the center of the city, change buses, and then go out to the west where Whitney Young was. But when she did that, by the time she got on the bus, it was already full. So she was on the bus an hour and a half and had to stand the entire way. And then she and her girlfriend finally figured out that if they took a different bus out first, and then caught a bus that went directly to Whitney Young, it took about the same amount of time, but because they went out and caught a stop earlier, they could sit while they were for the hour and a half. So an hour and a half in the morning, an hour and a half in the afternoon. She gets home at 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. She has really much more limited time with her parents, basically, not much at all. It's a tough school. She's got a lot of homework to do. So there are other kids, of course, that are being delivered by mom or dad, you know, and it's 10 minutes and they're at school. But she's got a much rougher day that she has to go through going to and from Whitney Young High School. But even that route into the city began to give her a different perspective. It's amazing how when she was a little kid up through the eighth grade, she really didn't go outside her neighborhood. Like she said, everything's within five blocks here. My family, my church, you know, where we shop, the elementary school, even University of Chicago was six blocks away. And she never, ever went to the University of Chicago campus. Even when she went to college, she had never been on the University of Chicago campus. She lived in a little bubble of her neighborhood. But when she went to Whitney Young, now she's taking a bus and she's going outside and she's beginning to be exposed to other things. She says, my first month at Whitney Young gave me a glimpse of something that had previously been invisible, the apparatus of privilege and connection. She had no idea what it was. But now, as she went on the bus and went through these neighborhoods and went through the loop downtown Chicago, she began to see what privilege was like. She says, most of my new high school friends were black. And it turns out a number of them had parents who were lawyers or doctors, and they all seemed to know each other. So she realizes there's this educated black community. Who knew? She was in a community where everybody was poor. And she just thought, that's the future. That's what you're destined to. But now she sees these black friends at Whitney Young, whose families have been successful. So she says, I spent a lot of time with a classmate named Santita Jackson. We passed hours sprawled on the floor of her room and her family's white Tudor house in the Jackson Park Highlands, a more affluent section of the South Shore. Now, turns out, her buddy Santita's father was famous. He was Jesse Jackson. You guys may not know the name Jesse Jackson, but in the era of the 1960s and 70s, this was a really famous character, probably the most famous African-American man on the political scene. And she says this was the primary and impossible to get around fact of Santita Jackson's life. She was the eldest child of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Now, at that point, he's a very big activist and a very well-known man in that community. But just a couple of years after they graduated from high school, Jesse Jackson ran for president. And hanging around her house could be really exciting. The place was roomy and chaotic. There were lots of people coming and going. But the big thing is that she could see that her family, Santita's family, was caught up in something larger, something messier, something more impactful. Their engagement looked outward. Her family was only concerned about what happened in the home. But Santita's family could look outward and feel like they could have an impact. And then, of course, just a couple of years later, Jesse Jackson runs for president. First African-American man to run for president, and is hugely visible on a national scene. So, because her mom went down in the second grade and got her out of that crappy classroom, and that she managed to get the best education you could get at a pretty bad elementary school and junior high, then she was able to go to this magnet school. And at the magnet school, she could begin to see there's another world out there that I wasn't exposed to, a world that is affluent, a world that has some privilege, and a world where people can make a difference in a larger sense. And so her exposure to Santita's family was super critical. Okay, so let's go back to Michelle's world. So early in her senior year at Whitney Young, she went to get an appointment with the counselor to start talking about college, because now she has other aspirations. She wants to go to college. She says, I turned up in the office doorway full of pride in the fact that I was on the track to graduate in the top 10% of my class, that I'd been elected treasurer of the senior class, I'd made the National Honor Society, and I'd managed to vanquish pretty much every doubt I'd arrived with as a nervous ninth grader. So she's getting that incremental small successes are building her confidence. She finds out she can be successful at Whitney Young High School. And now she's visiting the counselor to see, well, what's the next step? And she says, I noted my interest in going to Princeton the following fall. And although it's possible she said something positive and helpful, I can recall none of it. I got stuck on one single sentence the woman uttered. I'm not sure, she said, giving me a perfunctory patronizing smile, that you're Princeton material. So all over again, not good enough. Yeah, you're good. You're doing great, girl, but you're not good enough for that level. And so again, she's being discouraged from seeking that aspiration. She says, had I decided to believe her, her pronouncement would have toppled my confidence all over again, reviving the old thrum of not enough, not enough. She's still vulnerable to that threatening of her confidence. It's still back in there, somehow this sense that I'm not good enough. But she did not listen to that, and she went ahead and applied to Princeton, and then she got into Princeton. So she got her admissions in the mailbox. But when she goes to Princeton, then, you know, it's not that easy when she gets to Princeton. So she's in a living group where there's a triple room. She's got two roommates. She says they're both white and they were perfectly nice. But Kathy, one of my roommates, many years later, described with embarrassment something I hadn't known when we were living together. Her mother had been so appalled that her daughter had been assigned a black roommate that she badgered the university to separate us. Midway through our freshman year, Kathy moved out of our triple and into a single room. I'm happy to say that I had no idea why, but she's suffering from the same sort of pigeonholing and racial prejudice that had held her back to some extent before. So in 1981, when she was at Princeton, men outnumbered women by almost 2-1, and the black students made up less than 9% of the class. Just as it had been at Whitney Young, she felt like she had to prove herself. She felt like everybody else here has more privilege than me, and I've got to step it up to fight to, you know, get equal to everybody else. And she had that feeling of, I'll show you. In high school, it was like, I'll show you that a kid from my neighborhood can compete with kids from all over the city of Chicago. And here she felt like she was representing her race. I'll show you that someone of my race can do just as well as everybody else here. So she does quite well at Princeton and at the in her senior year, she's, of course, thinking, well, what's next? And she decides it's going to be graduate school and, in fact, law school. So she took her LSAT, and she wrote her senior thesis, and she started applying to the best law schools in the country. She saw herself as smart, analytical, and ambitious. And she is building that amazing confidence that she needed. Her professors, her relatives, random people asked what was next. And when she mentioned she was going to law school, and in fact it ended up, she got into Harvard, so I'm going to Harvard Law School, the affirmation was overwhelming. People were like, wow, that is so impressive. You have totally made it. This is great. So she goes to law school, and she's very successful again in law school. She has built the confidence to do exactly what the society says you should be doing. This is the key to success. This is the path to success. And she's hitting every rung, and she's working her ass off and accomplishing that. And then when she, she says that as you live, she says, you live as you always have by the code of efforts and results. And with that, you keep achieving until you think you know the answer to all the questions, including the most important one, am I good enough? Yes, in fact, I am good enough. And she's built that confidence for herself. She says, you reach for the next rung in the ladder, and this time it's a job with a salary in the Chicago offices of a high-end law firm called Sidney and Austin. These are extremely competitive law firms. And so this is one of the very best in the country. They have a Chicago office. She wants to go back to Chicago. Very competitive to get these jobs, even from Harvard Law School. And she makes the next step, and she gets that job. She says, you used to pass these high-end law firms by as a Southside kid rolling by on the bus to high school, peering mutely out the window at the people who strode by. And you thought, wow, these are titans. These are the kings of the world. And now you're one of them. And it's incredibly affirming to be one of them. She says, you've joined the tribe. At the age of 25, you have an assistant. You make more money than your parents ever have. Their combined income had never been what she made right out of graduate school. You wear an Armani suit and you sign up for a subscription wine service. You go to step aerobics after work, and because you can, you buy yourself a Saab. So she is getting that confidence. She's on the right path. She's doing everything that the culture has told her is important to do. So I want to, let's break for a little minute here and think, okay, how did this miracle happen? What is it that let her have the confidence to do that? What is it that enabled her to rise from a very, very modest background? And when other kids were not doing that, what do you think helped her and propelled her to do that? How do you build that kind of confidence? What do you think? Yes. What do you think?
I think a lot of it has to do with hunger. I mean, you just have some people who naturally want more than others, and when they really acknowledge that, they're willing to work a lot harder. So everything she did took sacrifice and hard work, and some people just aren't willing to put in that time and effort.
So she got confidence because she worked at it. She just put in the work, and that helped her prove to herself that, yes, you can. And you don't have to be a victim. What do other people think? How do you get that kind of confidence when you come from a background that doesn't nurture that kind of confidence?
I think that a lot of people have that hardworking mentality and attitude, but another large part of it is just the timing of like where you are in life. For example, like she went to Winnie Young just because like at the time it opened and she was lucky enough to be in a position where she could get in by like taking a test. But if it was like 1 year off or 2 years off, you never know if it would have the same result. Because like, as you said, Jesse Jackson's daughter wasn't the same grade at the time. So it's all also about like the timing that you are able to take these opportunities and like where it leads you.
So part of it is being in the right place at the right time, and that may be luck, or that may be to some extent making your luck searching out in another class. It might not have been Santita Jackson, but maybe somebody else who could have shown her what ambition and privilege looks like. What do you think?
I think part of it too is about developing resiliency. When she was just a freshman, she had a lot of self-doubt, and that kind of drove her. But by the time she was a senior and she got, told down by her counselor, she went ahead and applied to Princeton anyway. So she kind of learned that she didn't have to take everyone at their word.
I think part of it is just hard-headedness and just saying, I'm not going to accept this pigeonhole that somebody's got me in. I'm going to make my own. Yeah.
I think her parents probably influenced it a lot because they were very hardworking and never took a day off, and they cared enough about her to make sure that she was given opportunity to succeed. Like she didn't get stuck in that second grade class that she didn't want to be in. She saw that like with work she could get out of that situation. So she probably built confidence in that if there's a situation that you're in that's not great, you can probably get out of it with enough work.
I think the confidence that your mom stood up for you, even though that wasn't such a big move. It turned out to be a big move. And just realizing that I'm from a family where we don't accept that, where we fight for something better. Somebody back here have their hand up. Yeah.
I was going to say having that kind of confidence, I think, has a lot to do with your family upbringing and, like, the way your parents nurture you from when you're young. If they're boosting you with confidence, naturally your mind is probably going to develop to have a lot of confidence. But if you don't come from a family with that kind of upbringing, then you just need to find it elsewhere. Something my mom always says is, like, tell me who your friends are and I'll tell you who you are, because I think who you surround yourself with is really important and says a lot about you.
Absolutely. A big difference is who she surrounded herself with. And that was back in high school, and that was while she was at Princeton, and then at Harvard Law School. And she was, and you know, we'll find out later, she was very good at networking and finding who are the people I can relate to, but who also are ambitious and on a fast track.
Yeah, I can honestly relate to this story, because, like, during high school, like, people were telling me, yeah, you shouldn't apply to UT, or you shouldn't focus on getting into UT, you should focus on these other universities. I had several people, like adults, like, tell me, you should go to this lower level college, and I still applied, I still got in, I still came here. So I can understand, like, where she came from, like, that, like how people can, like, just drag you down, but you just got to get through it.
It is entirely true that you have to be rebellious enough in a way that you're not listening to other people, even authority figures, even people who are supposed to know that, you know, she just said, I don't believe you. Okay, so she's working for this law firm. It may be the fundamental problem with caring a lot about what others think. It can put you on an established path, my isn't that impressive path, and keep you there for a long time. Okay, this is something she's saying. She's saying she's on this good path. She's been very successful, but she says this may be a fundamental problem about caring a lot about what other people think. It can put you on an established path. My isn't that impressive path. And that was the path she was on. So here she is working in this high-rise office building in downtown Chicago. And she says, I did my job. I was a lawyer, and lawyers work. We worked all the time. We are only as good as the hours we build. There was no choice, I told myself. So she's working in this law firm. She's working her ass off. Turns out she goes on this business trip, and she's just working almost 24/7 for a week in Washington. You know, then it turns out the case settles, and all that work they'd done really didn't matter one way or the other, because the case never went to court. She says, however, I started keeping a journal. I bought myself a black cloth-bound book and kept it next to my bed. I took it with me when I went on business trips for Sidley and Austin. And she's beginning to be a little more introspective. In that book, she says, on the very first page, and in careful handwriting, I spelled out my reasons for starting it. I feel very confused about where I want my life to go, what kind of person I want to be. How do I want to contribute to the world? I'm confused about what I might do, what skills I might possibly have. Could I be a teacher or a college administrator? Could I run some sort of after-school program? I was interested in possibly working for a foundation or for a nonprofit. I was interested in helping underprivileged kids. I wondered if I could get a job that would engage my mind and still leave me enough time to do volunteer work or appreciate art or have children. I made a list of issues that interested me: education, teen pregnancy, lack of self-esteem. She's identifying her values here. A more virtuous job, I knew, would inevitably involve a pay cut. I wondered if I could find a job that would engage my mind and still leave me enough time for other things. I felt a slow growing certainty of my own. I wasn't built to practice law. She had done everything the external world told her was the right thing to do. She'd been successful at it. She'd worked her tail off. But when she's doing this at Sidley and Austin, she basically is working in financial services. So she's helping one billionaire company get $100 million from another billionaire company and just moving money around among extremely wealthy people. And it just didn't seem like what she wanted to be doing. And she just decided, in fact, I'm not built to practice law. So she goes on one of these business trips, and when she flies back in exhausted, her mom picks her up at the airport. And they're driving back home, and she says, "Are you okay?" my mom asked, as I looked at her in the half light of the freeway. "I don't know." And with that, I unloaded my feelings. I told her that I wasn't happy with my job or even with my chosen profession. "I'm just not fulfilled," I said. But fulfillment, I'm sure, struck her as a rich person's conceit. Her mom's thinking, "Dude, you are living the dream. You're making all this money. You drive a Saab. You wear Armani suits. You've got a wine subscription. You're doing step aerobics. You're doing what everybody dreams of doing. And this, you know, fulfillment thing? Seriously?" So her mom gave her a wry sideways look and chuckled just a little. "If you're asking me," she said, "I say make the money first and worry about your happiness later." So I want to know, all right, that's a very reasonable point of view. And this has to do with values, the values her mom has. And you can understand why her mom has the values she has. And now Michelle Robinson is, I gave it away, didn't I? Michelle Robinson is trying to figure out what are my values? What do I care about? What makes me feel fulfilled? And her mom and she are not on the same page here. Her mom is saying, just make the money and worry about your happiness later. And she's thinking, I just can't do this. I just can't work and work and work and work and feel like it doesn't matter. What I'm doing doesn't really matter. I don't believe in it. Okay, so this is and I want to make the point that if it weren't for the fact that she had confidence and that she'd gotten to the point of being very, very confident, she wouldn't be thinking about this. She had the confidence to step back and look at what she'd achieved and figure out, is this where I want to go in terms of the next step with my life? So I want to know a little bit of a reaction here. So do you think this is a whiner? Oh my God, what's she? I mean, she's in a really sweet spot here. Do you think, oh, you know, I totally get that. I see where she's coming from. What do you think about this? Questioning of her success in some ways. Yeah, what do you think?
I believe that if she feels unsatisfied with what she's doing, if she feels like she's not making a difference or not improving the world, then she needs to change her career and find a way to feel more fulfilled. If that means making less money then and being more happy, then that's, I think, a pretty easy decision for me. But I don't know if that comes from, like, the privilege that I've had of never having to worry about, you know, putting food on the table. So, yeah.
So I want to make the point really strongly that as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I'm a parent, right? I've got two sons. I've been in her mom's shoes, and this is the classic parent answer. Seek security first. Don't put yourself in jeopardy. And that's a value, you know, we talked about values you could respect. Boy, that's a value I can respect. I can respect her mom's value of you need to make sure you've got security. That's a very strong, very legitimate value. But now she might not have that value. Her values might be different. And maybe that's going to incline her to seek out different problems to solve than the ones that she's in the mode of solving at the time. What does she do here? And I want to make the point of this journal thing. You know, we're asking you to keep a journal. That journal thing is exactly what got her where she in a better place. So it was that sort of keeping this journal and recording what her thoughts were. Okay, so Michelle networked with her friends who had transitioned from private practice into public service. She wanted to do a little research. So in a way, she's doing creative problem solving. She's got this indeterminate problem. The indeterminate problem is, what am I supposed to be doing with my life? I'm talented, I'm capable, I'm analytical, I'm smart, I work hard. Now, what do I want to do with that? And it's an indeterminate problem. There are lots of different answers to that problem. So it's not like she's going to find exactly the right bullet. She's going to take some test, and they're going to tell her, okay, this is your perfect career because you took this test, and that's what you're vocationally inclined to do. That is not going to happen. It's an indeterminate problem. There are many, many answers to that problem of what you do with your life. But she's using her values to begin to understand how do I go about directing where my career goes. And then from her values, she's now doing that four-step process. And the first step is research. I'm trying to research what would it be like if I left this law firm? What are the alternatives going to be? Then she's doing this incubation. She's writing in her journal. She's, you know, thinking about it, mulling it over, incubating. And she's trying to then have this aha moment where she figures out, this is what I need to do next. So she's doing classic four-step problem solving. So she talks with these various friends, and she had a pretty good network at that point where she could test this out. And she eventually took a job as assistant to the mayor of Chicago. So she goes into public sector work. Now, just before that, today is an interesting day to be talking about this because they have a mayoral election in Chicago today. There are 14 candidates running to replace Rahm Emanuel. But at this stage of things, there had been a previous mayor that was the first African-American mayor of Chicago, Harold Washington. And he had been a hero of her and of the whole Chicago African-American community, a fantastic, extremely accomplished guy who became the first African-American mayor. And then he died in office. He had a heart attack and died at an early age. And then he was replaced by Richard Daley Jr. Richard Daley Sr. had been the big, Democratic political machine in Chicago and had been mayor for decades. And now his son was, running for mayor and became mayor. And so one of Michelle's friends had worked for Harold Washington and worked in the mayor's office. And she was super excited about what Washington was doing. Then when he died, she continued working for Richard Daley and said, you know, this guy has his head screwed on right. He's taking us a lot the same direction as Harold Washington. I wish it were Harold Washington, but, you know, this guy is going the right direction. So Michelle listens to her, and she takes a job as assistant to the mayor of Chicago. And now this is a very different job. She's working in City Hall. And she says, I would no longer be practicing law. My salary would be $60,000, about half of what I was making at Sidley and Austin. She says, City Hall belonged to the people. It had a noisy, gritty immediacy that I never felt at Sidney. She says, whereas I had once spent my days writing briefs in a quiet, plush carpeted office with a view of the lake. I now worked in a windowless room in City Hall with citizens streaming noisily through the building every hour of the day. She says, I went on missions to inspect fallen trees. I talked to neighborhood pastors who were upset about traffic or garbage collection and often represented the mayor's office at community functions. I even had to break up a shoving match at a senior citizen's picnic on the north side. This is a really, really different job than what she had at Sidley and Austin. Okay, so she's moving in a direction, and honestly, she's really energized. She is feeling like, I'm relevant, I'm living in the real world. And although it may be a minor problem of getting the electricity turned on after a storm, I'm fixing that problem. And I've got the capability to do it, and I know how to make things work. And she was satisfied in that job in a certain way. But it always seemed like it was just kind of fighting fires. Is that really what I want to do, is just fight fires? And so she's still in this indeterminacy thing. And she's still being very introspective. Where do I really want to go? And after a couple of years at City Hall, Michelle made another shift to align her career even more closely with her values. And at that point, she begins to get involved with this brand new organization called Public Allies. She says, I was hired to be the executive director for a brand new Chicago chapter of an organization called Public Allies, which itself was basically brand new. So this was a nonprofit, a whole new idea about how to approach a problem she cared about enormously. She says, Public Allies recruited talented young people, gave them intensive training and committed mentorship, and place them in paid 10-month apprenticeship positions inside community organizations and public agencies. So basically, they're going in and identifying people about college age-ish or just graduated from college, and identifying who are the people who could really make a difference in communities, and in especially underprivileged communities. And it might be someone who grew up in that community, or it might not be somebody who's ever been in that community. But we're trying to recruit people who will make their career working in these areas. She says, I still remembered at Princeton how so many of us had marched into MCAT and LSAT exams or suited up to interview for corporate training programs without considering or maybe even realizing that a wealth of more civic-minded jobs existed. She realized that, you know, a lot of people, it's not that they're deciding not to do these things. They don't even know there is a decision. They just follow the path that everybody affirms. You're right on the right path. Damn, you're doing just the right thing. Take that LSAT test, go to Harvard Law School, get that job with Sidley and Austin. That's exactly the path to go. And she realizes nobody ever even let me know that there were these other options. So Public Allies was a way of going to some of those same schools and saying, have you thought about working in the public realm or working in more civic-minded jobs? So that was one of the things they were doing, but they also were going to, you only had to have a high school degree to be a candidate for this, but trying to identify kids in those communities who might make a career doing this. And then they're mentoring them, and they're helping them understand things she didn't know when she was that age, even though she was working her butt off and trying to figure that out, just the information was not available. So she organizes this first class. She identifies, you know, it's a lot of work going out there identifying who are the kids who might be good candidates for this program. She says Public Allies was meant to as a corrective, a means of widening the horizons for young people thinking about careers. She says Public Allies was all about promise, finding it, nurturing it, and putting it to use. It was a mandate to seek out young people whose best qualities might otherwise be overlooked and to give them a chance to do something meaningful. And she was totally in charge of this brand new nonprofit operation in Chicago. So it meant, again, a big pay cut. And in fact, the initial salary they offered her was just not possible. She couldn't live on it. And she literally couldn't afford to say yes. But then, as she said, I still had roughly $600 of student debt to pay off each month on top of my regular expenses. But the organization's leaders managed to secure new funding that enabled me to come on board. So she had to compromise her lifestyle even beyond the half pay cut she'd taken to work at City Hall. And she begins to work in the trenches here. And she says, at Public Allies, success or failure would depend almost entirely on my efforts, not those of my boss or anyone else. She basically is an entrepreneur. She's out there. The idea is established, but how to go about it, how to do it, what to start your day with, what to, who to talk to, how to identify these. This is your job. You go out and figure it out, and you have to make a going operation out of this. That also meant getting funding. She said, I leveraged more or less every connection I'd ever made in Chicago, seeking donors and people who could help us secure a long-term foundation support. So she's trying to, you know, get the resources to make the thing operate, and she's really good at it. 25 years later, there was this network of public allies in 24 cities across the United States. The one in Chicago was a model operation, and now thousands of people have gone through that process and have benefited from that. So it was a very big challenge. It meant a lot of personal sacrifice. She was working her tail off doing that, just like she had at Sidley and Austin. But now she's feeling like, I'm helping kids who, some of them are disadvantaged kids, some of them are more privileged kids, but they all can be agents for change in the kind of neighborhood I grew up in, or the kind of disadvantaged community I was a part of. So let's try to figure out, is this woman, I don't know, maybe just a do-gooder, but you know, how do you sustain that over a longer period of time? Is this something that sounds reasonable, or do you have some concerns about where she's going with this? So I want to know, you were talking about that her mom earlier, you know, her mom was really great. Her mom's super disappointed here, you know?
Yeah.
So what do you think about, what happens when you go back to your mom and say, you busted your butt for me to be able to get lots of money and have lots of prestige and stature, and now I've gone this completely different way. How do you rectify that?
I think at this point she had the confidence to be able to stand on her own and do what she thought was best. But also, if it ended up not working out, it's not as though she couldn't go back to her career. It's not as though that wasn't waiting for her.
And part of what gives you that confidence is I know what I can do. I've got a plan B if this doesn't work out. And you know, I think that's probably pretty important. Okay, so what happens at this point? By the time she's 30, Michelle Robinson had already begun to make her mark as a successful advocate for disadvantaged young people. And then, you know, life changes somewhat for her. As First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama continued crusading for these values with two programs. So obviously, at a certain point, she marries Barack Obama. You know, she starts having a big responsibility in his campaigning and his public office that he holds, and eventually gets to be First Lady. But these values have not changed. And now she's figuring out, what can I do to be a creative problem solver, addressing these values in my new capability? She says, during my time at Public Allies, I saw the benefits of more formal mentoring firsthand. I knew from my own life experience that when someone shows genuine interest, it matters, especially for women, for minorities, for anyone society is quick to overlook. With this in mind, I started a leadership and mentoring program at the White House, inviting 20 sophomore and junior girls from high schools around greater DC to join us for monthly get-togethers. Then out of that, she creates the Reach Higher program that came out of the effort to encourage kids to strive to get out to college, and once there, stick with it. Reach Higher would seek to help them along the way, provide support and school counselors, and easier access to federal financial aid. So she basically started a new program within the federal government called Reach Higher that was doing a lot of what Public Allies did. Then she had another concern. In all this work with these communities, she realized that a lot of the problem was health, that these kids grow up eating terrible foods, and you know there's just a problem with their physical and mental health. And she realized that at the time Barack took office, nearly one-third of American children were overweight or obese. So as a way to help these communities and other communities as well, she decided to address the problem of health and diet, in particular among kids. She says most of what we knew about food had come through the food industry advertising of everything boxed, frozen, or otherwise processed. Nobody really was out there advertising the fresh, healthy stuff. So this is, I think, a brilliant bit of creative problem solving. So, okay, her values led her in this direction. She has a vision for trying to improve the health. What is the design? She decides to plant a garden at the White House. She realizes if I do something weird, the news media is going to be all over it. They're going to be all over it, and it'll get a lot of publicity, and then I can parlay that into other things. So she planted this garden in the White House, and there she is out there working in the garden. And she planned to use it as a way of sparking public conversation about nutrition, especially in schools and among parents. That would ideally lead to discussions about how food is produced, labeled, and marketed, ways that it affects public health. They ate food in the White House that came out of that garden. She sent a lot of the food from the garden to nonprofits that serve the homeless. They also made pickled vegetables and gave them to dignitaries visiting the White House along with honey from their beehives. She approached the problem from many angles. Her goal was to make it more than about government. She wanted to really speak to moms and dads and especially kids. She did everything from hula hooping on the South Lawn to talk about exercise to appearing on Sesame Street and talking with Elmo and Big Bird about vegetables. She just was working the major corporate chains, and because she had a visible position, she went to the suppliers of school lunches and got them to cut the amount of salt, sugar, and fat they used in the meals. They engaged the American Academy of Pediatrics to encourage doctors to put this on their priority list, the diet and the weight of kids. They persuaded Disney and NBC and Warner Brothers to do public service announcements and to encourage kids to make healthy lifestyle choices because kids were listening to that media. They made plans to bring green grocers into urban neighborhoods that were food deserts. They redesigned the aging food pyramid to emphasize fruits and vegetables much more. They got Walmart, biggest supplier of food in the country, to cut the amount of sugar, salt, and fat in its food products and reduce the prices of produce. Eventually, she took it even a step further, and she began to get legislation. She worked hard to put through a new child nutrition bill through Congress, expanding children's access to healthy food in public schools and increasing the reimbursement rate on federally subsidized meals for the first time in 30 years. And this was phenomenal. That bill passed in Congress 264 to 157. That was a Republican Congress. They were killing everything that Obama put out there. But Michelle Obama works bottom up first and gets all these allies bottom up. And then she goes around to top down and there's no way they can say no to it because there's the buy-in of everybody along the line. And in that program, they were able to substantially change the diet and provided meals in school programs for 43 million meals served daily and establish guidelines for what vending machine food would be like on campuses and completely made a change in what we